But more than that, every child, every person deserves to be respected for the contribution they make. My sister was a counsellor. I think this guy's obviously got a pass from the 2019 conference. We changed the party.
So clearly a protester quite late on in the speech there, interrupting Keir Starmer's speech here in Liverpool. A round of applause from the audience as he makes a joke that he was a Jeremy Corbyn era member of the party.
We've been changing the party. That's why we've got a Labour government. The conference. The point I was making is this. Every child, every person deserves to be respected for the contribution they make. My sister was a care worker in the pandemic. She is still a care worker. Work that surely by now we know is so important for the future of this country. So wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great if this was always and also a country where, because of that contribution, that vital life-affirming work, she could walk into any room and instantly command the same respect as the Prime Minister? Because those are my values, that is what I believe, and those are the values of the Britain that we will build. Will people get to show for it? They will get a country with its future back, renewed by respect and service, rebalanced towards the interests of working people, confident in its values and story, because together we took action. Millions who feel better off without just being told they're better off by politicians, going to the supermarket without a calculator because the nation's numbers now add up. More money in their pocket to do the things they love. More faith in their public services because once again, Labour rebuilt them. An NHS facing the future. More security and dignity at work. Town centres thriving. Streets safe. Borders controlled at last. Clean energy harnessed for national renewal. New homes, new towns, new hospitals, roads and schools. A new future for our children. That is what people will get. And mark my words, we will deliver it. People said we couldn't change the party. But we did. People said we wouldn't win across Britain. But we did. People say we can't deliver national renewal. But we can and we will. We will stabilise our economy, clear out the Tory rot, fix the foundation and deliver the mandate of change. A Britain built to last, built with respect, built with pride, because together we have shown that Britain belongs to you. Thank you, conference. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, conference. Thank you.
So we are, Keir Starmer delivering a speech just under an hour in length, stressing repeatedly that his was a long-term project, but insisting that the work of change has begun, ruling out what he called easy answers, instead promising practical solutions to the country's problems. He promised to clear away what he called the Tory rot and building a Britain that belongs to you, joined on the stage by his wife Victoria, as they hug on the stage, and he waves to The crowd on its feet here in the Liverpool Conference Centre. I'm joined still by Patrick Maguire from The Times, Katie Balls from The Spectator. Heavy on the diagnosis of the country's problems. What do the solutions, he calls them, the practical solutions, rise to the occasion, do you think, Patrick?
I think it was thin on specific practical solutions. I mean, some of the only announcements in there were pretty piecemeal. Housing for every homeless veteran, a location that we all sort of knew already for GB Energy, the government's new electricity firm. I think optimism was the mission, and at the beginning and the end of that speech, which I think were the strongest passages, we got a lot of it. As you say, heavy on the diagnosis, very, very long passage about migration, trying to balance, which is very difficult for the Labour Party, that sense of humanity, trying to appeal to those reform voters who are breathing down Labour's neck in lots of Northern and Midlands constituencies, and also making a new argument saying the Tories can't control migration because, unlike the Labour Party, they're all about the free market and importing cheap labour. So there was a lot in there. I'd say there's probably too much in there. Quite hard to follow at times, but I'd say he'd be happy with how it was delivered, the beginning and the end, and his response to the heckler. Whether people are convinced by the pretty threadbare solutions in there is another question.
So in terms of the actual policy announcements, we committed to a pledge to bring down net migration, saying alongside that the Labour government would invest more in skills so that firms don't have to import workers. A crackdown on welfare fraud and abuse, on tax avoidance and tax evasion. And that scheme, the housing scheme, Houses for Heroes, he called it, where armed forces veterans, along with care leavers and victims of domestic abuse, will be able to get access to social housing by lifting. Currently, when you apply for social housing, councils have to prioritise people with a local connection to see if they're eligible. And what they're saying is they're going to lift that. The problem, Katie Balls, people have already got in touch with us and said there's already really long waiting lists for social housing. So it might, in a way, you're just adding people to that list unless there are the homes. And again, there was a lot of talk about planning reform and telling people directly, everyone's going to play a part in this. If that means prisons or wind turbines or pylons or new homes coming to you, well, that will be popular for the people who want the new home, but less popular for people who are having that building near them.
Yeah, and as you say, particularly on the veteran announcement, it does seem to come back to supply, and that's something that's going to take time, even if Labour do push ahead without any problems on the planning reforms. I think on that point when he, you know, had those 3 points saying, you know, if we are going to have cheaper energy, some of you are going to have to get used to a pylon. It was, I think, that idea of the purpose of come and buy into these difficult decisions, because there is a point that we get to them. And again, the sense that he's willing to be unpopular when he has to be. So I think returning to themes, there was clearly an effort to try and join up difficult decisions with results.
The upside, that comes with the downside.
And a little bit of optimism in that quite difficult balancing act.
I think we can go live to the hall, actually. Our colleague Helen Catt is there. Hi, Helen. Who have you got with you?
Hi, I've got Jonathan Reynolds, the Business Secretary, with me. Jonathan, what did you make of that speech?
I thought it was a fantastic speech, and I thought it did what we wanted to do with this platform of conference, which is to link, yes, we've had to make some difficult decisions, but they are to get to that better future. That's the change that we want to deliver. You know, the link between being able to house veterans, because we're going to do those changes to planning and build homes, the opportunities for young people in the arts, because we're going to change the taxation of private education. This is the message we need. Yes, change has begun, but it links to where we've had to make difficult decisions. The purpose is the better future we want.
But there was a warning in there that people are going to have to suck up some things they don't want. Some communities are going to have to live near prisons. If you want cheap electricity, you've got to have pylons. But that's quite a hard message to sell people, isn't it?
I thought it was candid. I thought it was candid in a way that the British public will respond to, because that's exactly it. If we don't want to have the kind of prisons crisis the last Tory government left us, that means building more prisons and having more space behind them. If we want homes for our children, for our families, yes, some of those are going to have to be built, and it might not be ideally where everyone wants them to be. But isn't it fabulous to have a Prime Minister who levels with the British public, tells them if that's the good future you want and that's what we want, this is what it will involve, but you will benefit from it. And I think to politics in Britain to return to that kind of quality is long overdue.
I mean, there was a lot about trust in there. He didn't quite say it, but the idea that people have lost trust in politicians. Do you think that speech is going to be enough to convince people to stick with you?
No, I think this is part of a mission for the whole government, and ultimately the success or failure of that will be, are people better off at the end of this Labour government than they were when we went into it? You know, whatever the shambles of the last Tory government, the bottom line was people were worse off, and that is the frame about which we went into the election. We have to show people they can be better off, that our policies will do that, and this speech is part of it, but of course there's a long way to go. But what a clarity of direction from the new Prime Minister.
Brilliant. Well, Jonathan Rose, I'll let you go. You're lots of people here wanting you.
Thank you.
Did you get all that?
Yes, thanks. Just because you're in the main conference room there was a protester quite late on in the speech. Was it just one person? Did you get a better sense of who they were, than what they were protesting about?
No, it was quite room. It was quite quiet. So it was one chap alone, just in a T-shirt, didn't have a flag or anything like we've seen in recent years. He was on his own, just shouting, so it was a bit quiet. There was a here, though, I have to say, was during the speech, you could see a lot of security people sort of walking around. So, they did manage to get through the old
whizzy machine is cutting out again, as expected. Helen, amazing, managed to get Johnny Reynolds in full. So thank you for that. Helen Catt there, live from the conference room, confirming it was correct for me not to do it myself. I'm still joined by Patrick Wire from The Times, Katie Balls from The Spectator, and now Liam Thorpe from the Liverpool Echo. Were you in the room?
I was in the room.
Did you catch what the protester was talking about?
I think it was a Gaza protest that I heard.
Okay. Yeah. That was quite late in the speech, given that he talked about Gaza earlier on.
I think we were all expecting something early on, and as we could see from the handouts that we were right near the end of the speech, I think that they thought that he'd finally cleared it from the protest, and then maybe they decided to wait till a little bit later on. But it was, unlike the Rachel Reeves protest yesterday, this was handled a little bit less aggressively, I thought, and he was just sort of ushered out the back. I think Starmer definitely had his line prepared in response as well.
And how did it, I mean, I was going to say, how did it go down in the room? Everybody loved it, presumably, because that's what
happens. Shockingly,
yeah. But he was trying to sort of communicate, Katie was touching on a minute ago, try to communicate a sort of slightly difficult message. If you want the good stuff, there's a downside to it. And I just wonder, maybe this is something we could all talk about. Is it better if people, if you're the government, is it better if you leave other people to point out the downside? Is he in danger of sort of talking down, you know, let other people complain about the downsides of the housing and the pylons and all of that, rather than putting it up in lights?
I think he certainly has been in danger of being too negative, and that speech in the Rose Garden that has now gone down pretty badly. I thought this was a little bit more optimistic than that, obviously pragmatic and realistic, but it built more of a narrative, I thought. It had more of a story with a bit of hope at the end of it. And, yeah, it built to a nice flourish at the end, and it did go down extremely well, as you would expect, but I think he's got a lot better at these things, to be honest, and he seemed a lot more comfortable. I thought it was pretty decent.
Patrick McGuire, right, yeah, I mean, it was sort of Gordon Brown-esque, wasn't it? The clip that certain Labour people love sharing online, Gordon Brown's last speech.
Chief of New Labour.
15 years ago, the last time a Labour Prime Minister made a speech at conference, listing their achievements to a crescendo of applause. And that was the sort of thing that Keir Starmer looked like he was trying to capture.
Well, he did it several times, listing what they'd done thus far, listing what they hoped to do, which is what Gordon Brown did in 2009. It's gone down in history as a sort of eulogy for New Labour, listing all their key achievements. Keir Starmer also lifted the phrase Gordon Brown uttered at the end of that list, which was, that's the Britain we've been building together, that's the change we choose. Both Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves using that similar phrase, that's the Britain we're building. But as you say, we're 12 weeks into a new government. Obviously, they have to create a sense of dynamism. I'd say most people watching at home and listening at home would gently question the idea that this government is doing lots and lots of things. Much of that list is sort of things they announced and things they're going to do. And it's very easy for us to get caught up in the moment and saying, look, it's all a disaster, they're not doing enough. Look, they've got a majority of 170 and they're in power for 5 years. But how they spend these first 100 days, how they set the tone for what they're going to do, will determine how well this next 5 years goes. Have they perfected it? I think the jury's out.
Matt, can I just point out that in that famous Gordon Brown speech, one of the achievements that he lists rather awkwardly is the winter fuel allowance.
The very first one on that list.
Which is and he did make a passing reference, a glancing reference.
Very, very, call. Very minor, yeah.
The cutting the winter fuel payments is part of balancing the books and getting the country's finances back into a better state. If you are just joining us on 5 Live, we've just been bringing you Keir Starmer's speech live here from Liverpool. Let's just pick through some of the key moments in it, and we've mentioned it as Patrick was just there. So the list of things, trying to hammer home the idea that this is a government which has already been doing a lot of things. Just to take a listen to that.
The work of change has begun. The patient, calm, determined era of politics as service has begun. Planning reformed, doctors back in theatre, new solar projects, new offshore wind projects, the onshore ban lifted, Great British Energy launched, one-word Ofsted judgments ended, a border security command, a national wealth fund, getting Britain building again, the Renters Reform Bill, stopping no-fault evictions, and the Railway Services Bill, bringing railways back into public ownership.
And that was one of his early lists. He did another one a bit later on. Let's turn our attention then to the Middle East, because that was what the protester who was removed from the hall was protesting about. And that has been a difficult policy area for the Labour Party and for the Labour government. Let's just take a listen to what he had to say there.
So I call again for restraint and de-escalation at the border between Lebanon and Israel. Again, all parties to pull back from the brink. I call again for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the return of the sausages, the hostages, and a recommitment to the two-state solution. A recognised Palestinian state alongside a safe and secure Israel. And that's the message I will take to the UN General Assembly when I travel there later today.
Now, this is clearly a very serious and sensitive issue, but we can't not reference the fact, as several people have got in touch on the text that pointed out, he did say he was calling for a return of the sausages.
The return of the sausages. The hostages.
It's unfortunate.
That is slightly...
I completely missed that in there, actually. That's remarkable.
I mean, loads of people immediately got in touch on the text and the WhatsApps. Other people... Pam says, in the first minute this speech, the PM mentions the country getting better for workers. I'm a pensioner and I feel I've been consigned to the scrap heap. That's Pam, aged 70, in the Wirral. Lots of sausages messages. Reporters, be honest, this speech is a load of nothing, says someone. And then someone else, George, says he's not the most electric of public speakers, but if he's a boring hand on the tiller, I will take that. What a great speech from Keir Starmer, really powerful and positive. It's what we need, says Mike. Someone else says, what a load of hot air from a man who's delusional. I just don't want to hear any more about Keir Starmer's family. I don't listen to Brahms, says someone else. Waffle, awful stuff. What did he say? Nothing. It sounded like a hustings, says someone else. 850058, if you want to get in touch on the text. Katie, it was interesting because there was quite a lot of sort of defining himself against the Conservative Party and still, without mentioning him by name, defining himself against Jeremy Corbyn and, you know, how he changed the party and references to the 2019 and all of that. And actually, he's in government now. Like, you have won that argument against the left and against the Conservatives. Does he need to keep on referencing back?
Well, he clearly wants to position himself and keep on going for his potential opponents. But as you say, I think now you're in government, I think the problem with that speech, and people say, oh, well, journalists would say this, is it didn't really have too much about what he planned to do now. Now, it had the broad themes that he's often returned to, but it was still, you know, large parts of it were kind of attacking others. And then also, I mean, we learned a lot about the Lake District as well, once again. Mm. But it was, you know, attacking others, a few personal moments. And I do think when you're listening to it, it's slightly, okay, come on now, but you just had this really big victory, so let's hear a bit more about how you plan to go on forward with this plan. So we got flashes of it. I did think one of the stronger points is when he said, you know, if you want some of these things, you might have to take a pylon, lose your winter fuel lamp. You know, I thought that was quite direct, but I think there could have been a bit more of that. And I also thought there was an interesting passage where he talked about the bad faith advice from people who still hanker for the politics of noisy performance. It's water off a duck's back.
I think he's talking about us.
I think that might be about, you know, well, clearly...
Well, when he was talking about Brahms, he was saying that's what he turns to when the reviews are not good. So he's clearly...
Yeah, and I think after Wardrobe Gate and so forth, I think that passage to me said, you know, you might try and drag us into these petty bothers, but we'll continue with the serious, you know, efforts of service. So I think that was a bit of a kind of a fighting talk or a suggestion that he isn't, you know, particularly feeling too much like it's his government's fault for the past few weeks that played out the way they have.
I should remind you that, as ever, I'm continuing my search for a Five Live listener in every constituency of the country. Today's constituency is South Basildon and...
East Thurrock.
East Thurrock, thank you, Patrick.
Well,
South Basildon and East Thurrock. Have you got any claim to South Basildon? Because of Keir Starmer's speech so far, we're a bit thin on the ground of people with connections to South Basildon and East Thurrock, so this could be a very easy way to get yourself a Five Lives rosette. 85058 off the texts. Your best claim to South Basildon and East Thurrock. Liam Thorpe, in terms of your readership on the Liverpool Echo, what's the headline from this? Maybe there's a question for all of you, actually. What is the defining theme, moment, phrase, message, do you think?
It's an easy one for us, because obviously he started his speech with the announcement of the Hillsborough Law, which we actually splashed on today because we had a little trail of it. And that is just a historic moment in Liverpool, and it's an incredible achievement by everyone who campaigned for it for so long. And Keir Starmer stood up here 2 years ago and promised he was going to do it, and now it's actually happening. There will be more devil in the detail as it goes on, but that is a clear change in the law. It is a clear legacy for the 97 Liverpool fans who were unlawfully killed, and it's a big moment for this city. So that will be yeah. our lead story. But I think that there was obviously a couple of little bits of, I thought, new policy stuff around housing and housing veterans and care leavers, victims of domestic abuse. As Katie says, we were never really expecting much new. You know, we've had the manifesto and we've got a budget coming up. This is just kind of fleshing that out.
It's a weird year.
Yeah, it's a weird period, isn't it?
We're actually going to hear from some campaigners for the Hillsborough Law just after 3:30, so we'll bring that on Five Live a bit later. Patrick, your headline?
Well, look, if I was editing the Times, which thankfully I'm not...
Only a matter of time.
Well, I don't think so. I would, obviously, like Liam, I'm also from the region. I write about his tribute to Southport tradesmen, because my dad is a painter decorator in Southport, so it's good to hear some recognition for people like Des McGuire.
Big up the Southport Brickies.
Oh, yeah. Sadly, he's a brother of the brush, not a Bricky, but, maximum respect for the Brickies. No, I'd say, I wonder whether the headline is something like, you know, Defiant Starmer faces down critics, promises better times tomorrow. You know, there wasn't really a big announcement that jumps out at you. I think it's a question of tone. And I think the tone was one, as Katie said earlier, of defiance, of no. Despite the noise, we are sticking to the strategy we have set. And whether that works and whether people are going to be enthused by that is another question. But that's sort of what the vibe... It was a vibe speech, not a sort of content speech.
Well, let's actually remind ourselves then of when he was trying to land that message, light at the end of the tunnel, you know, good times ahead, trying to deliver some of the optimism, moving beyond his speech in the Downing Street Garden over the summer, where he talked about things will get worse before they get better. Let's just take a listen to that light at the end of the tunnel passage.
That if we take tough, long-term decisions now, if we stick to the driving purpose behind everything we do, higher economic growth, so living standards rise in every community, our NHS facing the future, waiting lists at your hospital down, safer streets in your community, stronger borders, more opportunities for your children, clean British energy powering your home, then that light at the end of this tunnel, that Britain that belongs to you, we get there much more quickly.
I mean, it was slightly hidden in a great big long list there, Katie, but I mean, is that the message he wants to say, that there is, things will get better, rather than focusing quite so much on the rocky roads or the dark tunnel or whatever the metaphor is?
I think it is. I think it's effectively they're trying to do a course correction, which is there's been lots of misery because they know there are some even more difficult decisions perhaps than the winter fuel allowance. But they've suddenly realised that that's affecting consumer confidence, business confidence, and it seems to be annoying a lot of previous Labour voters. And they're trying to say there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's just you're going to have to pass some pylons and etc. en route. But bear with us, because we promise there's a light. And if you all play along with this, we'll get to the light quicker.
I noticed when my colleagues in the press, everyone just circled pylons on the sheet. I know, so I think that's going to get a lot
it's
of
a huge,
traction.
It's a huge... Because it came up at PMQs a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an issue that in Wales, the Labour government in Wales isn't... is committing to putting more cables underground, but the Labour government in England isn't. And there's this tension, because if we need more power, then you need to get the power from the whatever it is, the power station or the turbine, to homes, and that requires a lot of pylons.
It's become quite a sort of symbol of something,
yes,
hasn't it?
Yeah. And it's become a sort of... because it's much more expensive to put the pylons under the ground, so therefore it costs more money. Patrick, what have you been picking up from the conference in terms of... It's got... ladling on the doom and gloom, you expect it from the when you're in opposition. You go around saying everything's terrible. And then when you're in government, normally the government goes around saying everything's marvellous. Mm. And the opposition goes around saying everything's terrible. And if the government is going around saying everything's terrible and it's going to be grim, so buckle up. You know, you're doing your opponent's work for them to some extent. And as Katie was saying, it has real-world impact where people start thinking, well, maybe I'm not going to, but you know, change the car or get the decorators in and get the front room done or whatever it might be. That spending that money and creating that growth becomes an issue. Is there a feeling that they probably have overdone it, that actually maybe it might have even been a mistake to go into Downing Street and start saying, brace yourselves, folks, it's going to be miserable?
Look, the proof that they have realised that that was having a real impact for business and consumer confidence was in Rachel Reeves's speech and the tone and the framing, which was much more optimistic and did suggest that this was all capable. What Labour was doing was capable of lifting the spirits of the economy and helping out. I'd say the mood here, though, certainly among MPs and ministers and cabinet ministers, is sort of, there's a flatness about it. I think people are reluctant to be seen to be too celebratory, precisely because Labour has spent the past 12 weeks banging on about how difficult its inheritance is. Maybe that's changing right now. Look, I'd say activists are certainly jubilant. You saw them let themselves go in that speech, the first they've heard from a Labour Prime Minister in 15 years. But you know, let's see what happens at the budget, because that is the real political moment of this year. This is all a bit of a phony war before the toughest political decisions are taken.
Big difference is it isn't raining today.
Yeah, true.
Literally, the sunlit uplands feel slightly closer after yesterday's downpour. So, Matt Jolly on Five Live, still joined by Patrick McGuire from The Times, Katie Bulls from The Spectator, Liam Thorpe from The Liverpool Echo, and now some Labour activists, Chris and Sarah. Sarah, how did you find it? Were you in the room for it?
I was in the room, yeah. I'm here as a delegate.
You're here as a delegate.
Yeah.
What was the thing that leapt out to you and you thought, yes, I like that bit?
Well, I've got to say, I'm here from the Musicians' Union. Ooh. So we're really, really delighted. I mean, just that breadth of knowledge of what's needed in the country now.
Is this him talking about playing the flute?
He was talking about playing the flute, yeah. Why not? At school, it was one of his best experiences, was to go on a... It was his first trip abroad.
Yeah.
Was on a music trip with his school.
So then how does... I liked playing the flute, that gave me opportunities. How does that then manifest itself in the real world? What's the sort of follow-up that the Musicians' Union wants to see in terms of policy?
Well, the policy is that the creative activities have been stifled in our schools for years and years now, and poor kids just haven't had access because schools are so much under the cosh. They've got to do the 3 hours, morning, noon and night, and it's a very different picture in private schools where they've always kept the value of sport and music, and state schools have really lost that. So to actually hear that in the leader's speech is, for us, just amazing.
What's the did he play the flute with Fatboy Slim? Is that the connection?
Violin lessons with Fatboy Slim.
He did violin lessons with Fatboy Slim. Keir Starmer.
Did he?
At Reigate Grammar School in Surrey, yeah.
There we are. So
there you go.
You've learned something there.
I have learned something. Thank you for that.
Chris, what did you make of it?
Well, look, I think it was great. It was inspiring, you know. I mean, Keir Starmer is such an inspiring character, and I think this speech was just representative of the optimistic mood that we've had throughout this whole conference. You know, we're ready to change, we've started to change, and the change is going to continue.
Was there a single thing, like, Sarah, was there a thing that you thought that's the thing that I like?
I loved his reference to the riots, you know, the violent thuggery, you know, they don't represent Britain, they will never win, and I think that was great. You know, it was emotional for me personally to listen to that, and it's great, I love it.
Fantastic, really good to see you both, thank you for that, Chris. Sarah's got some trivia now, you can go off and use that.
Is he a member of Fatboy Slim of the Musicians' Union?
Maybe, there we are.
What a scoop.
He's Keir Starmer, though. That's the big question.
Even the Funk Soul Brothers got to unionise, you know.
Well, Labour MPs do have to be a member of at least one trade union, so maybe here's the Musicians' Union.
Well, we'll try and find out. Helen Catt has been in the hall for us, our political correspondent. She's managed to catch up with Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary.
Bridget Phillipson, what did you make of that speech? I thought it was a brilliant speech, really hopeful and optimistic about our country's future.
And what was it, what in it really struck a chord for you? Because we got a bit of personal care in that as well, didn't we? Was there anything that really struck a chord?
We did get a lot about the Prime Minister's experience and how that shaped his views of politics and why he believes in public service. I think what was really powerful was when he talked about how he wants to make sure that all young people can achieve and thrive. And that does involve making sure all young people get, making sure that all young people get the chance to study subjects like music and sport and art and drama, and also, you know, the commitment that was made around more apprenticeship starts for our young people, so that wherever you are in the country, you have a chance of a good job, good training and good prospects.
I was going to ask you about that, because he did quite a lot, actually, on the value of the arts and creative studies. Is that something we are going to see reflected in the coming years in schools, in education?
So I've already launched a curriculum and assessment review to look very closely at that, because I do want to make sure, as the Prime Minister said, the access to areas like music and drama, and not just for those whose parents can afford to pay for it, but for all of our children. And I think the Prime Minister spoke very powerfully about the difference it makes to young lives.
And do you think that he did enough there? There's been a lot of criticism about doom and gloom and people not really being able to see what sort of sacrifices that you're asking for are leading to. Do you think he did enough there to convince people?
Look, we have had to make tough choices. We've been upfront about that. And, I recognise that is the job of government, but it's also the job of government, as Keir set out today, to demonstrate a hopeful and more optimistic future, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
And the last one, so your speech is tomorrow, is the Soraya conference?
That's right.
So are you going to be busy prepping tonight? No parties for you, you'll be at home swatting up?
I'll be having an early night tonight, but the speech is pretty much there, but it always needs a final eye just to be absolutely sure.
Brilliant. Bridget Phillipson, thank you.
Thanks so much to Helen Catlett, our political correspondent, prowling the conference hall and rounding up cabinet ministers. I think we have a cabinet minister of our own in the next half hour. Wes Streeting, the health secretary, joining us live here in Liverpool at the Labour Party conference, reflecting on Keir Starmer's big speech, the first by a Labour Prime Minister at conference for 15 years. We are also still looking for a new member of Matt's Parliament for the constituency of South Basildon East Thurrock, which, as Patrick McGuire told us at the beginning of the show, is where this band were formed. Well done. Good knowledge, that, Patrick. I want someone with a connection to South Basildon and East Thurrock. We've not got much time. We've only got half an hour to find someone. Whatever your claim is, have you been there? Are you a member of Depeche Mode? Do you like Depeche Mode? 850-58 on the text, or you can WhatsApp 08085-909-693, and we'll get you on before the end of the show. You can get yourself I've signed a massive pile of certificates. You get yourself a certificate to put on your wall and a rosette in five live colours. And frankly, who doesn't want one of those? Your best connection to South Basildon and East Thurrock, 850-58 or WhatsApp 08085-909-693. Coming up in the next half an hour of the show, we'll reflect more on the Hillsborough law we were talking about with Liam Thorpe a moment ago. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, will join us, and more of your reflections on Keir Starmer's big speech. But now let's get a news update from Dan Maudsley.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks, Matt. Well, as we've been hearing, Sir Keir Starmer has been giving his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister, promising a Britain that works for you and serves the interests of working people. But he also warned of tough times ahead, saying people should be wary of easy answers to the country's problems. Well, among the policies announced was a pledge for homes for all veterans who need them, and confirmation that a Hillsborough law requiring a duty of candour on public officials will be introduced to Parliament before the next anniversary in April. He said the law would apply to public authorities and public servants and include criminal sanctions. Israel has carried out fresh attacks on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon after airstrikes yesterday, which Lebanese government officials say killed 558 people. It was the deadliest day in Lebanon since the civil war, which ended in 1990. And more than 20 flood warnings are still in place in parts of England after torrential downpours left some areas submerged. Roads have been closed and rail services disrupted, but there is some respite today with generally drier weather. Jonathan McKeith has the sport.
Dan, thank you. Let's get the latest from Durham. England's cricketers taking on Australia in the third match of their one-day international series. Ellie Aldroyd is there for 5 Live.
And England's cricketers breathing a bit of a sigh of relief because the very dangerous Glenn Maxwell has just fallen to a second excellent catch by Brydon Carse off the bowling of Liam Livingstone. Maxwell out for 30. He put on a 50 partnership with Alex Carey. They were going at more than a run a ball, so upping the rate considerably from earlier in the innings, the catch that Cass took to dismiss Steve Smith, definitely worth watching back on the BBC Sport website and app. Smith was out for 60, Cameron Green 42, but Alex Carey still there on 47, the danger man for Australia, but they can bat all the way down at the innings. 226 for 6 Australia after 42 overs.
Ellie, thank you. Commentary right now on Five Sports Extra. Arsenal's Mikel Arteta has refused to dwell on Sunday's eventful 2-2 draw with Manchester City. On the subject of perceived time-wasting, Arteta said he'd be very thick if he'd not learned from previous mistakes. Arsenal lost 5-0 to City 3 years ago, having had a man sent off. He also said the team had picked up several injuries following Sunday's draw and hit back at claims his side had adopted football's dark arts in order to take something from the game.
I always prefer the facts than words or supposing things. So let's see who is available tomorrow and then we can talk about dark arts or these things.
Arsenal are in EFL Cup third round action tomorrow at home to Bolton. Tonight, Five Live has commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Sports Extra has Walsall against Leicester after the cricket finishes. Meanwhile, more than 100,000 litres of water have been pumped out of AFC Wimbledon's flooded Plough Lane home after the entire stadium was left underwater. The club's managing director has told the BBC the pitch has suffered significant damage. It's after a nearby river broke its banks on Sunday night, forcing tonight's EFL Cup tie against Newcastle to be postponed. It will now be played at Newcastle next month. Meanwhile, Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag has hit back at criticism of his decision to put Marcus Rashford on the bench for the first hour of the Premier League draw with Crystal Palace. He says it was simply rotation and it's not right that he's not believed.
I didn't understand the criticism, but yeah, people, they are entitled if they want to, but what they are not entitled to bring speculation in. Huh? If I give an explanation, then they have to trust my words and to trust my explanation.
And Britain's Fran Brown has defended her C1 individual time trial title at the Road Paracycling World Championships. That's in Zurich. For now, though, that's your latest from BBC Sport.
Coming up this week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 8, 5 Live has commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham. Today there's ball-by-ball coverage of England against Australia in the third ODI on Five Sports Extra.
And tonight at 8, Aston Villa travel to Wycombe in the EFL Cup.
Five Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us.
Matt Shawley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Very good afternoon to you, Matt Shawley, coming to you live from the Labour Party Commons in Liverpool, where, what, about half an hour ago, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, rounded off his big speech to the party faithful, where he was trying to be a bit more upbeat, promising light at the end of the tunnel, saying he wasn't going to go for the easy answers, saying he was going to clear away what he called the Tory rot and build a Britain that belongs to you, listing all the things. Yeah. Which he says the government have already done, defining himself against both the Conservatives, who he ousted from office, but also the era of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. A number of policy announcements. GB Energy will be headquartered in Aberdeen, being one of them. An announcement that armed forces, veterans, care leavers and victims of domestic abuse will get better access to social housing. A pledge to bring down net migration while increasing skills in the UK so firms don't have to import workers. A crackdown on welfare fraud as well. But saying that there will be difficult decisions coming down the track as well, and trade-offs. If you want green energy, then you might need to have pylons near your house, that people might have to get used to having a new prison or new homes near their own homes as well. So there's quite a lot in the speech. Another announcement that we're going to focus on now here on Five Live was the detail of confirming a Hillsborough law will be introduced in Parliament before the next anniversary of the tragedy in April.
A law for Liverpool, a law for the 97, a law that people shouldn't have had to fight so hard to get, that will be delivered by this Labour government. It's also a law for the sub-postmasters in the Horizon scandal, the victims of infected blood, Windrush, Grenfell Tower, and all the countless injustices over the years suffered by working people at the hands of those who were supposed to serve them.
Keir Starmer there, outlining the detail of what's known as a duty of candour on public bodies. Well, I'm now joined by Elkan Abrahamson, who's a Liverpool lawyer who's represented many of the Hillsborough families and is the director of the Hillsborough Law Now campaign. Good to see you. We've also got Gary Rogers, a Liverpool fan who was at Hillsborough on the day of the disaster. And still with me is Liam Thorpe, political editor of the Liverpool Echo, who's covered the story extensively. Gary, let's start with you, first of all. Why is it so important for you to see this law finally being enacted and ended up on the statute book?
Yeah, well, it's important to for me and the families to get this law over the line and keep the accountability of the original council. Excuse me. The original accountability from 1997, which Andy Burnham introduced. So, but it's important that we keep move on forward with our own account, our own bill to be put forward to the Labour government, you know, the conference. Yeah.
Elkan, explain what it actually means in practice. What is a duty of candour, and why is it born out of what happened at Hillsborough?
So, a duty of candour in this case is a statutory duty imposed on public bodies and public officials, and we hope people acting in a public capacity to tell the truth in any inquiry and to volunteer relevant information, not just to wait for the relevant question to be asked. And it's all about cover-ups. It's there to prevent cover-ups, and Hillsborough was one of the early and biggest examples of a cover-up, but we see it again and again in inquiries. We've seen it in Grenfell, we've seen it in the post office inquiry, we've seen it in the infected blood inquiry. Nobody will ever say, oh yeah, this is what we did wrong, we're sorry. Everyone covers their back. So the idea is, if you don't cooperate with an inquiry and tell the truth, you may go to prison.
And how important is it for you, Gary, to see that happen there, that people are held accountable?
Well, it's very important. I mean, people can't go through life trying to cover everything in court. But in general, I'm just so delighted that the Prime Minister has brought to conference. Yeah. And it's just given us that little bit more hope now. But there's still a hell of a lot more way to be done with Hillsborough Law. And it's only right that proper people get right accountability.
And Liam, just it was interesting because he sort of spelt out what would be in the bill. But with all these things, it's the devil's in the detail. What is covered and what isn't?
Yeah, and Elkan will tell you that, because once the lawyers get into it, it's you know, things can change. And I was speaking to one of the family members this morning, and she said this is a massive step, but the fight doesn't stop there, and it's absolutely essential that the families and the campaigners remain, you know, in constant communication with the government, civil servants, and over this kind of legal process, the legislative process, because they can't just be cast aside now. They've got it to this far. They need to be involved as it makes its way through Parliament. They know what a Hillsborough law should look like, and it can't be watered down. And that is sometimes the fear. But, you know, this is the first and biggest hurdle. The Prime Minister, obviously, was getting it in the manifesto. Now we've heard it from him. It was 2 years ago that he announced it on this stage. And I think these guys would say, you know, at the time, there was a suggestion that it might never quite happen. I think a lot of people think it, you know, we don't believe it until we actually see it happen, and now it is happening. But I think there's still probably quite a long way to go until this starts to change lives. I think the important thing to say is that the Hillsborough families now want to do this for other people. They want the legacy to be for other people so that they don't go through what they went through.
It was interesting because you made reference to post office scandal and those other things we've seen since, so it has sort of has a greater reference. Elkan, Gary, Liam, really, really good to see you all. Thanks for joining us on Five Live. I'm now joined by the newish. Do you still consider yourself newish Health Secretary? Where's tweeting?
I feel very old.
Well, that's because you've been staying out till four in the morning, I read.
No, these are scurrilous rumours that I will not entirely deny.
They're not rumours, then, are they? They're facts.
Well, there was a ridiculous story in one of the newspapers suggesting that as the health secretary, I was going to curtail licensing hours at pubs, and so I thought it was important to demonstrate my commitment to longer hours.
When you say it was a ridiculous story, it was based on comments from one of your own health ministers who said that the government was going to look at limiting opening hours, addressing opening hours to try and improve the nation's health.
We're not doing that.
No. And is your colleague Andrew been told that?
Andrew knows we're not doing that.
Did he know you weren't doing that before he announced it?
He definitely does now.
Presumably you're not taking him to the pub for a while. should we get it out of the way then? Tell me that was the best speech you've ever heard in your life.
I can't answer that question. What I know Keir wanted to do coming into this conference, having spent the summer
talking
about the, well, I think levelling with people about the scale of the challenge facing the country, the state of the public finances, and the importance of fixing the foundations. I know he was determined to come into this country, into this conference, as in his first speech as our Prime Minister, and set out the home he wants to build on those foundations. And I think he showed in that speech not only real vision and a real plan, but the grit and the fire in the belly that he has as the Prime Minister. We've seen that in the Labour Party over years, because he came in and changed this Labour Party when no one thought it was possible, turned it around in record time to get us in a position where we could win the general election. So we've seen that steel and that grit in Keir Starmer as leader of the Labour Party for some time now. I think today the country looking in on our conference would see their Prime Minister with that grit and that steel and that vision.
When he talks about a light at the end of the tunnel, when he talks about there will be trade-offs, but, you know, if everyone gets on board, we'll get there sooner. When can people start judging the new Labour government on whether or not you are delivering on that? When do things start looking better rather than you telling us it's all terrible?
Well, based on my experience of the last few months, people have already started judging us.
When do you stop telling us it's all the fault of the Tories? And when do you start saying, look, things are now better, aren't they?
Well, people will see improvement over the course of this Parliament, because we know if you want to deliver a decade of national renewal, you need to win a mandate for it. And we believe very strongly that you don't own people's votes, you earn people's votes. People lent us their votes at the last election. They placed their faith and their trust in us at the last election to deliver on our manifesto. And we got to now repay that trust by delivering on our manifesto and showing people a country that's finally moving in the right direction, where at the next election they can see that their waiting lists are lower, that there are more police on the streets, that there are more teachers in our schools, and that things are really improving. Look, Prime Minister knows that. And the thing I thought really came out in the speech was the Keir Starmer that I see privately up there publicly on the stage, which was, yes, the warmth and the humour, and I love the joke about the woman who said she'd have pushed him down the stairs if she knew he was a politician. But actually, that grit and that steel and the way in which he holds us as his team to account for delivery. You saw the reaction in the hall. I mean, people at the conference absolutely loved it. I think the country will see now that they have got a Prime Minister with a real vision and a Prime Minister who's willing to really confront some difficult issues and arguments take on vested interests.
It's not a huge surprise that Labour Party members at a Labour Party conference liked the Labour Prime Minister's speech. Out in the country,
I don't know. I've been to some Labour Prime Minister's speeches in the past.
If you look, talking about those people who lent you their votes, the people who switched the Labour Party, if you look at the polls, and it's not one poll, right, across a lot of pollsters, since the election, Keir Starmer's personal ratings and the Labour Party have gone down. People are disappointed. They feel let down, whether it's on the gloomy stuff or that the freebies, people think it's wrong that he's been taking these freebies. They don't understand why someone else is buying his wife's clothes. They can't understand why Sue Gray's paid more money. It's been a rocky time. You've only been there for 2 months, and already Keir Starmer's personal poll ratings are now worse than Rishi Sunak's.
It is not a surprise to me, given the state of public trust in politics and politicians, that we start from a low bar in terms of, you know, people voted for...
No, but you started from a high bar. My point is, you started from a high bar, and he's gone down.
And I think it's a reflection of the fact that people voted for change at the last general election. They put their faith and their trust in us to deliver that change, and we will only see those poll ratings improve when people see change being delivered. They're going to judge us on our actions now, not simply on our words. It was important important, though, that today they heard the vision of the Prime Minister, the vision for the country. And I think we'll take reassurance from the fact that, unlike the sort of government by gimmick we had before, the short-term is sticking plasters, this is a guy who is willing to take on difficult arguments, who's willing to make the big calls and take the hard choices today that will build a brighter future for our country tomorrow. That's exactly the sort of political leadership we need in our country. It's the sort of political leadership that's been missing in our country for far too long.
Are you on Team Morgan McSweeney or Team Sue Gray?
I find these questions so tedious. No disrespect to you, Matt. It's a fair enough kind of question to ask as a journalist, given some of the headlines. But I work really closely with both of them. Mm. And the frustrating thing for me is sometimes you read stuff in the papers about what's going on and you kind of sigh and think, oh, it's really annoying because, you know, you don't want your dirty laundry in public. With these stories, I've looked at them and just thought, this does not match my experience of working with these people. We are so lucky to have Sue Gray in Downing Street, someone with enormous experience of how government works, helping us to get things done. We are so lucky to have one of the best political strategists on the left anywhere in the world, who was part of that team that saved the Labour Party and has put Keir Starmer in Downing Street now to change our country. These are brilliant people and they are a real team, and we are a team. And I think one of the things that I think across Whitehall people have noticed since this government came in is that you've got in Keir, in Angela, Rachel, myself, the rest of the cabinet, a team of people who firstly genuinely like each other, who were forged in the fire of opposition and had to work hard together as a team to win, and as a result we're a strong team for the country now.
Let me ask you about your job, because there's nothing more annoying than a cabinet minister coming on and not even talking about your brief.
This is so difficult, because my speech is tomorrow, so I now have to try and talk about it without spiking it.
What's going to be in it?
Well, let me tell you. Shall I deliver it now on air?
No, not the whole thing. I don't want to listen to it twice.
Look, actually, building on what the...
But I want to ask you about the nurses. In the middle of Rachel Reeves' speech yesterday, the Royal College of Nurses rejected your payoff of 5.5%. Are you going to budge on that? Is there any room for manoeuvre?
I get the message from the nurses. I spent a lot of time in opposition and talking to the nursing profession. I was as angry, frankly, as the rest of the country that nurses were forced out on strike by the Conservatives because they weren't shown basic respect. So I'll sit down with the Royal College of Nursing and the other unions who represent the nursing professions, treat them with the respect they deserve, work with them to improve their working conditions, and work with them to improve their pay. And look, I know.
So there could be an improvement on 5.5%.
Well, I think the public sector pay deal for now, for this round, has been settled, but people shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it was a big judgment call by the Chancellor to settle those public sector pay awards. They were independent pay review body recommendations, and Rachel made the judgment that firstly it's important to rebuild confidence in those pay review bodies so that we don't end up in industrial disputes and pupils and patients and passengers being inconvenienced by strikes. But she also made that call because we want to improve our public services, and it was in the interests of pupils and passengers and patients that she made that call. It was the right choice, the right priority, and nurses have finally got a government they can work with and a government that's on their side.
But they don't think they have. They've rejected your pay offer. So how are you going to resolve that dispute? Are you saying 5.5%, that's it? Or is there any room for improvement?
And the Chancellor has settled this pay round.
So that's it.
Of course we can talk about the future and the future we want to build with the nursing profession. And we'll also, in the meantime, start taking actions in the shorter term to improve the conditions that nurses are working in our hospitals and in our communities.
One of the things that we get loads of messages about, and it was a big part of the election campaign as well, how long should it take for you to get an appointment with a GP?
Well, I remember the good old days under the last Labour government where people were complaining on BBC Question Time because if Tony Blair introduced the guarantee of 48 hours to access a GP, GPs were held to account on it. And as a result, if someone wanted to book an appointment next week, they were told they had to book one in the next 48 hours. What a lovely problem to have. Can you imagine that today? I'd love to get back there, Matt. I've got to be honest with people. That change will take time. But look,
back to this point about judging us on actions. Within weeks of taking office, I reprioritised budgets in the department to put £100 million into employing 1,000 more GPs onto the front line before Christmas. I did that within weeks of coming in. The junior doctors' strikes that they hadn't settled for a year and a half, I agreed a deal with them within 3 weeks of coming in. On public health, taking action within weeks to put into legislation the junk food ad ban to stop junk food being targeted at our kids and driving childhood obesity. Did that within weeks. Just done that within the first few weeks. Imagine what we can do over the next few years and imagine the country we can build over the course of the next decade with the leadership Keir set out today.
How long will it take until I can get a GP appointment in 48 hours?
Well, because it's you, they probably see you pop up on the list, don't they? And they see you faster.
I'm the man of the people, Wes. I'm not trying to jump the queue. How long will it take?
As I say, Matt, it is going to take time. I've already put 1,000 more GPs onto the front line before Christmas, but I've also, in terms of the plan we're building, the 10-year plan for our NHS, primary care, general practice, pharmacy, those community services, that is a big part of my reform agenda. So I'm not going to make promises I can't keep, but I can reassure people that at the next general election, not only do I want waiting lists to be demonstrably lower, I want their access to GPs to be demonstrably quicker.
You're doing your speech tomorrow. Does that mean you're not going out tonight?
I will be out and about across the course of the evening, keeping my eye on all of these delegates we can see around us, making sure they're behaving reasonably.
Will you be singing at the karaoke?
Everything in moderation.
Will you be singing karaoke?
Well, the risk of singing at the karaoke is, as you can already hear, there is a hoarseness in my voice.
You want to go and see a GP?
If I could get an appointment. But I obviously do lots of talking at conference, and I'm a sensible person. So everything in moderation, Matt, that's my health.
What are you going to be singing at the karaoke?
Well, I'd love to sing Changes by David Bowie, but I haven't got the range.
No.
No.
So there aren't going to be enough. Maybe you could do Changes, but in time, over an unspecified timescale. Wes Street in the Health Centre. Thanks so much for joining us.
I can see why you're on talk radio.
Wes Street, good to see you at Health Centre. Thanks so much for joining us on Five Live. Patrick McGuire, Katie Balls are still here. A final thought from you both, Patrick?
Well, my final thought is, as ever, I think Wes Streeting communicates much more clearly what the government is trying to do than the Prime Minister himself.
Would you like to be Prime Minister, Wes?
That might be a problem over the next 5 years.
Do you want to be Prime Minister?
I think Patrick was listening to an entirely different speech. I thought we had absolutely crystal clear clarity.
Would you like to be Prime Minister one day? You'd like to do it one day, wouldn't you?
Tell you what, looking at the difficulty of the job.
Would you like to be Prime Minister, Wes?
No, I'm actually very happy to be the Health and Social Care Secretary. Thank you very much for the offer, though, Matt.
I mean, we've obviously still got a day to go and the big speech, which is Wes's. But I think you can say, I think that at the moment, conference looks like it's ending on a better note than it started for Keir Starmer, yes. Moving from Wardry Gates to the things that they actually want to be talking about and that have dominated this show.
There we are. Lovely stuff. Wes, nice to see you.
Thank you, Patrick.
McGuire from The Times, Katie Balls from The Spectator. Thanks so much for that. Well, we'll round off by trying to find a member of Matt's Parliament with a connection to South Basildon and East Thurrock. We've got a couple of listeners on the line. Is Jack there? Hello, Jack.
Hi.
Where in the world are you, Jack?
I am in East Thurrock, so actually the chairman of a 100% fan-owned football club that set up earlier this year.
That's amazing. What's the football club?
So it's called East Thurrock Community Football Club. The old club, East Thurrock United, went into liquidation in August last year. And we're a group of fans. We set up a 100% fan-owned football club to replace it.
That's very, very good, Jack. That's a very good claim to it. We've got some other, though, to try and challenge you. Johnny, hi, Johnny.
Hi, Matt.
Where are you and what is your claim to South Basildon and East Thurrock?
Well, I'm in South Buckinghamshire, but in 2008, I met a girl. So my now ex-girlfriend, because I'm 36, so quite a long time ago. And she was from East Tilbury, which I think is just in the south of the borough. And I went there to meet her mum, maybe once or twice.
I'll be honest, Johnny. I
heard you were struggling. So, I responded.
I mean, we've just had Jack, who set up a football club in the constituency. You once went and met a girlfriend's mum there in 2008.
I think maybe twice.
Right. Well, I appreciate it, but I'm not sure it's going to quite make the cut, Johnny. Steve's on the line as well. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Is your claim to South Basildon better than I went there once to meet my girlfriend's mum?
Well, I was born in that constituency in 1985. I went to nursery there, went to primary school there until I moved down to the Isle of Wight, and so that's my sort of claim to that.
Have you been on before, Steve?
I have, yeah, when I was living up in when I was for Stockton.
Oh, you were trying to become the MP for Stockton?
Yeah, I could become
You've got perseverance, if nothing else.
Well, look, Farage stood for election God knows how many times, and I've lived in about several dozen constituencies in the last few years. So I could be on the whole series.
I mean, I appreciate your perseverance, Steve. I actually quite like the fact that you might come on regularly to make increasingly spurious claims. So I think I've got to give it to Jack. Jack's done a good thing. He started a football club in the constituency. Well, yeah. Jack... where's Lindsay Hoyle? Here he is.
You are now a member of Matt's Parliament.
There we are. Jack, we will send you a certificate and a rosette in five live colours.
Thank you very much. Ironically enough, I do actually work in Houses of Parliament on the side. So,
there we are.
Very much.
You didn't even have to throw that in.
Thank you for welcoming back to Houses of Parliament.
There we are. Thank you to Jack and to Johnny and to Steve. Thank you to Patrick and to Katie and to Liam, who brought us all of the excellent reaction and analysis on the on Keir Starmer's big speech. I'll be back tomorrow doing it all over again, but not in Liverpool. I'll be back in London tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Drive is next right here on 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Let's get your BBC News headlines now. Sir Keir Starmer has been giving his first Labour conference as Prime Minister, promising a Britain that works for you and serves the interests of working people. But he also warned of tough times ahead, saying people should be wary of easy answers to the country's problems. Among the policies announced was what's become known as a Hillsborough law requiring a duty of candour on public officials, which will be introduced to Parliament before the next anniversary in April. The Prime Minister also pledged homes for all veterans who need them.
Cannot stand by and let this happen anymore. So today I can announce that this government will respect that service. We will repay those who served us and house all veterans in housing need. Homes will be there for heroes.
The Israeli military says it will step up its offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon after yesterday's intense bombardment, which left hundreds dead. Lebanon's health ministry says 6 people have been killed and 15 injured in an Israeli airstrike on a residential building in Beirut's Dahiya suburb, a Hezbollah stronghold. Unconfirmed reports say the target was a Hezbollah commander. Well, earlier, Lebanon's health minister said more than 550 people have been killed since the Israeli strikes began yesterday. Large numbers of people are continuing to flee their homes in southern Lebanon after Israel warned people to leave, causing traffic jams on routes north. Our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Pechega, is in Beirut.
To give you an idea of how congested the roads from southern Lebanon to Beirut are, a journey from Nabatea to Beirut, which usually takes an hour and a half, it is now taking 14 hours. So across the country, around 150 schools are now sheltering displaced residents. And in the hardest hit areas, hospitals are said to be overwhelmed.
Several people have been arrested in Switzerland after a controversial assisted suicide machine was used for the first time yesterday. The device, known as a Sarko, allows people to end their lives without the aid of a doctor. By